This is GamesAtWork.biz with your hosts, Michael Martin and Michael Rowe. This is GamesAtWork.biz, episode 8. Game storming.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Games at Work. And this is Michael Martin. I'm coming to you from my home office here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I am delighted that my co-host Andy Piper is with us today. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Michael. And yeah, it's great to be on the show again. Sorry, I've missed a few episodes through various travel commitments, but I'm over here in the UK. It's a fairly miserable spring day, but I am very excited because we have got our very first guest of this reboot of our podcast together, James McInniffo, who's a co-author of a book called Game Storming. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Andy, and nice to talk to you again, Michael.
I'm really happy to speak with you too, James. James and I go way back 4, 5, 6 years. We're trying to figure out how far. And I'm delighted that we'll have a chance to chat with you about the book, your experiences in games and gaming in business, and a variety of other elements. It's a little miserable here too, Andy. But any day when there's basketball going on is not miserable because I'll be inside watching basketball.
Who's playing? I'm going to show my ignorance as to the basketball leagues, right? So your team is which one?
My team is the North Carolina Tar Heels from Chapel Hill,
and
we are in the midst of March Madness, as they call it. So it is tournament time for the various conferences. So that's all going on around the country this week, and next week begins the NCAA tournament, which is even bigger madness at a bigger level.
And away from sport, of course, also this week is we've had a couple of interesting tech things. We've had the announcement of the new iPad from Apple, and we've also got the start of South by Southwest Interactive. That's beginning to clutter up my Twitter stream. So just to throw those couple of tech points into the show as well.
Oh, absolutely. And Michael Rowe, if he were here with us today, I'm sure would be chiming in on both of those. So quick poll. How many of us have already placed our order for the iPad 3? is that a yes, James?
Not yet. I'm kind of surprised that in the tech news update, you didn't throw out a bid for the Higgs boson evidence that was discovered this
week. Actually, that's true as well. Yeah, no, that's pretty exciting as well. It passed me by though, James, because I'm so excited by the iPad 3. No, I haven't pre-ordered mine actually. Although I am going to be over in the US the week that it's released, so we'll see about maybe picking one up, but we'll see.
So quick segue from the God particle to the God device to the I've actually placed my order, and Michael has as well. So this will be my first iPad, by the way, and we'll see if I become as enamored with it as everyone else who has. My wife loves hers, absolutely loves hers, and is on it every evening reading books and so on. I had something else I was going to go to. It was really witty and clever, so insert that here.
So I was just going to mention that I'm reading my copy of Game Storming actually on the Kindle, and as I'm sure we'll mention when we talk to James in a moment, there's quite a lot of nice hand-drawn kind of artwork, which actually comes out really nicely on the Kindle, on the regular, you know, e-ink Kindle, because it's not too complicated. It's nice and simple drawing. Maybe what we talk about first, Michael, is a link that we had shared with us from our friend Kirk.
Yes, exactly. So I remember my clever bit, and I'll use it later in the show, I'm sure.
Okay.
Our friend Kirk sent us a link that is extremely appropriate to start off our conversation today. And this is from theweek.com, from their site, talking about how drinking vodka actually makes you more creative.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, duh.
That was sort of my initial reaction too, duh.
Well, but as the article says, you know, how much vodka are we talking about?
Right.
Not a lot.
So, Michael, this reminds me of just yesterday I was reading about anti-patterns in development processes. And there's, I guess, one commonly known as the alcohol-fueled development process. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all seen this chart where, you know, it goes up steadily and spikes as your alcohol consumption increases. That's your sort of coding ability. And then it pretty steeply drops off after that. I think the same thing absolutely applies to creativity. Sure, why not?
So would you guys agree that there might be such a thing as developer beer goggles?
I
this code looks great.
I know, and as you may remember from when I was over in Raleigh in RTP with you guys, I'm awesome at pool after a few beers. So I'm definitely more creative with my shots on the pool table at that point.
Well, you know, the thing that struck me when I read Kirk's referenced article here was that when I go to conferences, I do find that some of the most intriguing experiences, great ideas, come out of sitting at the bar after the main events of the conference are closed. So I don't know if you've encountered that before too, but it just seems that it does loosen people up just a little bit, like the article suggesting, allows your mind to go in a freer way to see connections between things that might not be as obvious and allow for an additional set of creativity. So,
I give it a plus one. One reaction I have to that is I ask this poll a lot. How many people have their best ideas in meetings? And it's very rare that someone says, yes, absolutely. A meeting is the environment where I go to do my most creative work, whether it's the bar, the coffee shop, taking a walk. The shower is a popular one, of course. Well, there's something going on there. Yeah.
Well, I mean, one thought I have is that I have my most interesting thoughts actually when I'm driving for some reason. But I guess... the meetings are important in order to kind of share those points of view, but you need that kind of time after the meeting to kind of synthesize those ideas that you've absorbed or you've heard, and if you're engaged enough in the meeting to be creative. That's just that's just throwing that out there. It's something I guess I've encountered.
Yeah, actually, it reminded me of something one of my teammates has said once, which was especially when it comes to decision making in meetings. He calls back to Bedouin cultures, where these tribal people would meet to decide on something, but they would never decide something the first day. They would never decide in their meeting. They would deliberate well into the evening, at I guess their own equivalent of the bar in the evening, and then decide in the morning. So I think that's something I try to bring to my work when I'm thinking about how to design an experience that's got some sort of decision in it.
I like that. That makes a lot of sense, and it certainly plays to the let's sleep on it concept. That's pretty common as well. So James, let's talk about the GameStorming book a bit. I certainly enjoyed going through this as much as Andy and others here have too. I really liked the concepts in the beginning of the book to talk about getting people into the frame of mind for the journey to get to a new conclusions. Creative conclusions, because you have to allow people the freedom to experiment and to play. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, based on your long experience, because you've done this, you've facilitated, you know, countless meetings, and you've brought these experiences of play into the meetings. How would you say that evolved from your experiences into a book, and how you were able to conceptualize those entering into a state of play, conducting the state of play, and then closing it in a way that Andy was just describing too?
Yeah, sure. So thank you for the plug for the book. I think version 1.0 of the book is pretty good. What's actually sort of impressed me more is what's come out of it, sort of the community that's been developing around it. So the games that we collected in the book and the thinking that we collected in the book has really sparked some fire for some people. And there's a community, if I can put a plug out there for the Go GameStorm site, where people are contributing their own games and ideas and the things that are working for them. So that's, to me, what's really interesting is when these things start to grow on each other. So I think I think some of the response to the book, the positive response to the ideas that are there, come from a very simple place, which is that we design everything in our lives. We design we talked about the iPad. You know, we take our gadgets very seriously. We take web applications and web experiences very seriously. And so why not apply that same sort of thinking, that same design thinking to what happens when people get together in a room to do something together, whether it's create something or decide on something. I mean, that's that thing that happens when we get together to work on things, which we need to do. We're social animals and we need to work on stuff together. That ought to be designed intentionally and thoughtfully. So play is certainly a part of that.
So James, would you say that there's a certain kind of person or kind of team that lends itself really well to this, or some teams that, you know, need some work that to get into this frame and this flow?
Absolutely. So one way I think of it is, say, I facilitate a lot of meetings with a lot of different groups, and the culture word is kind of dangerous because it's sort of airy and it means a lot of different things. But when I think about it, I just mean, what's the mode of operation for this group? What's their, you know, what are their comfort levels and so forth? And you're going to find different groups in different places. Some people are super collaborative. There's a loose correlation here between like an East Coast, West Coast thing. And maybe that metaphor helps. But like when I'm going to facilitate a meeting on the West Coast, you know, it's very open, it's very collaborative. Like there must be collaboration happening. Otherwise, the output is not valid. Meanwhile, on the East Coast, you find folks who are a little more intense, a little more, this is not in every case, I'm totally stereotyping, but a little more like, all right, let's get this done. Let's get to the answer. Consensus, we don't care about. Let's do it. So you got to meet people where they are. That being said, I think there are certainly techniques that you can use in both cases to kind of bring, in my mind, the groups closer together. So when I'm working with a very collaborative group, a very sort of like, hey, let's hang out kind of group, I tend to bring a little more East Coast. And the reverse is true. When I'm working with people, you know, in banking on the East Coast, you know, my first job is to loosen them up a little bit. And I think that's something to think about in terms of, you know, bringing these things to life is, you know, what does the group need and where do you have an obligation to pull them?
Very interesting. Andy, would you say the same sort of thing might apply in the UK? North, south, east, west there too?
I'm not so sure, actually. I think, you know, bearing in mind the comments that James just made about culture, I think it's a bit more homogenous generally, but I may be mistaken. James, I wonder if you'd mind just, you know, since you're a guest this week, and many of our listeners may not have come across the Game Storming book, maybe just talk to us a little bit about the basic principles that you talk about and effectively how the book's laid out. Because I think I've been flicking through it myself the last week or so, and I'm finding it really accessible. Maybe you could just talk about, you know, your thought process putting it together.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we set out to write the book, so I'm one of the three authors, and to help you discriminate, Dave Gray founded the company that I work for. He's the tall one. He's the guru. Sunny Brown is she's the short one, but she's also brilliant, and she's very sassy. If you haven't seen her her TED Talk on the Doodle Revolution, it's really amazing stuff. So I guess I'm the one of middling height who just has been doing this for a number of years. And so my perspective, I think, that I tried to bring to this was the most pragmatic one, which was, you know, what's the stuff that actually is going to work in the real world? So when we set out to write the book, basically the problem was that there were a lot of things that a lot of companies were doing in terms of collaboration, a lot of teams were doing differently, and there was no one place where all this had been collected. So we didn't set out to write a fiction of our own, but instead take more of the Brothers Grimm perspective, which was to collect these things into one place. I say the Brothers Grimm because, if you guys don't know, they didn't write the original folk tales. What they did was oral traditions, oral stories that had been passed down. And what they did in their first round was just collect them and write them down. And so that was our approach with the book. In terms of, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, actually, you know, as a speaker, I often find that some of the best talks don't necessarily present new ideas, but they put together a bunch of stories and make ideas more accessible. Just, you know, I often sit in a conference presentation, and the best speakers I find are those who just, you know, weave together that kind of story. It's all based on things that, you know, may have come before, but they just put together that kind of coherent narrative. So yeah, I like the idea of that being kind of, as you say, the Brothers Grimm approach of just kind of collecting together a bunch of things that have existed in disparate places, or orally in their case, and just putting together something coherent from it.
Sure. Yep.
So you took that approach, and then, you know, you've obviously got a set of kind of methods and things in the book, but then kind of the latter half of it is really a set of game storming challenges, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the front half, I think we kept it brief, is essentially the principles, what we call the 10 essentials. So these are the things that, if you think of them as, if you just tore off those pages from the book and said, okay, now I'm going to go design an experience for a group to accomplish some goal, you'd be pretty well equipped. But people don't want just the principles. They want stuff that they can go execute and try out right away. So the remainder of the book, and actually the bulk of the book, is call them techniques, call them exercises. If you want to be brave about it, you can call them games, because I do think that there are parallels between game design and experience design. And that's where a lot of the just sort of stuff you can try out right away is. So, yeah.
Talk a little bit about that, the game design and experience design pieces. That's intriguing to me.
Yeah, this is a fun one for me, because I've always loved games. I've always loved games since I was a kid. You know, I grew up having strange uncles who took me to their D&D games. So, you know, I started out as 9 years old, like kind of, you know, getting comfortable with role play. So, remember, my brother's a game developer. So, you know, we've always passed back and forth notes on game design. But when I started facilitating meetings, essentially as a professional about 7 years ago, I didn't think of games as being what we do in meetings. In the course of writing the book and working with Dave and Sonny, you know, we started playing around with these concepts of, you know, what's a way to describe this thing that we do when we get together? Well, you know, when you take any given exercise, you know, you have a goal for the exercise, you have the rules for the exercise, you have the, the people, the participants, and what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. You have artifacts in space for most of the games that are visual in nature, to keep track of information. The same way, if you look at a Monopoly board, you have meaningful space and you have counters and things representing information and relationships to each other. So, you know, it's in some cases it's a pretty the metaphor is it just starts and stops there. It's, you know, you can think of the elements of a game design, all the raw ingredients that you need to answer for in terms of the game, in the same way that you think of any other experience to solve some other goal or objective.
So what I like about what you just said is that, you know, in some games they're very tangible methods that you sit around a table and you're playing the game. So Dungeons and Dragons is terrific. You know, you're right there, you're rolling your D20, it's telling you whether you hit and whether it's critical or not. You play Monopoly or Risk or any one of these other board games, and then you're right there, you're manipulating objects that are a key part of the game. And in many cases, you know, going through the book here, and this is really an intriguing point for me, is that the gameplay and the game elements rely heavily on the player participation.
Absolutely.
And they require player participation in person. So say that six times fast, alliteratively. Where the intriguing follow-up for me is I can play Monopoly on my iPhone. I can play Scrabble or Words with Friends, you know, in a virtual way. When I think about the collaborations that I tend to do with my colleagues, Andy's a great example of this. You know, Andy and I, in the long time that we've known each other, we've seen each other in person a total of one time. yet, you know, we've forged a really good relationship. We are able to play and exchange and create together really well. When I'm thinking about the various games that we have here, some of them I think could lend themselves really well to distance play over things like screen sharing and the like. You know, the $100 test, you could screen share, you know, the board of saying, okay, where am I going to spend my $100 on which of these features or priorities or whatever. When you went through the book and in the subsequent community that's forming around this, how much time, energy has there been spent around the notion of how do you play these games in a virtual way, and, you know, maybe the creation of assets that would facilitate virtual play of some of these key games in a way that, you know, would be more than just screen sharing?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a couple people who are working on that in particular, because it's not just in my mind, it's not just solving for the remote problem. You know, so how do we do a post-up activity when we're in different cities? But it's also solving for a scale problem, because if you can do it in a remote way, you can also do it at a much larger scale. So, I mean, I'm used to facilitating meetings from 6 to 50 to maybe 200 on the outside people. And you can do a lot of really interesting stuff with groups that get bigger. And so when I look at, for example, the work of Luke Homan, who is behind, he wrote a great book called Innovation Games, which preceded GameStorming, and you know, set the stage for a lot of this. And he is working on a platform to do just that. So any of the games that are in GameStorming, you can basically apply a Visio spatial template to a space and do meaningful things with it. So I'll just leave it at that. It's totally worth checking out. It's called innovationgames.com. There are some other ones. For me, I think the important thing where things are at right now in terms of distance collaboration is just not over-engineering it, because these games and experiences work when they're flexible, when the parts sort of loosely fit together and the barriers to entry are low. Because you know, say you've got a skeptical audience. You've got a group that literally doesn't want to pick up a pen and write something on a post-it note or sketch out what they think their picture of the problem is. You know, wherever we can eliminate those barriers, and it's always, in my mind, going to be easier in person, but from a technology perspective, just keeping it super, super simple and flexible and letting the actual use cases emerge is the way to go. I'm a fan of just using PowerPoint and a tablet computer to sketch along with a meeting when we're doing it remotely, because you can, I mean, then you're basically just, you've got a group whiteboard and you can do whatever you need to do.
And kind of a live blogging, doodling, sketching kind of thing.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing that for today. Like, no, nah, I don't. Gosh, I don't want to dominate the conversation. But if you guys want to do it, you guys go for it.
Well, no, I was just going to throw in actually on the subject of tablets and collaboration. You know, one of the interesting things that came out of the new iPad announcement, and I think one of the things that's going to once again keep Apple significantly ahead of the game is. The stuff they demoed with GarageBand and the ability to now have four people playing collaboratively to create a song using, you know, over Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. Obviously that's musical, but you know, you can imagine, you know, four people sat around in a meeting space and maybe one person sat remotely with their tablets and just, as you say, sketching those kinds of things in real time. That would be very powerful.
That is very cool.
Well, and not to get too Apple dominated, but that's also part of the new Apple TV and the next generation of the OS for the Mac to be able to throw up on a screen what your screen has.
Yeah.
So there's a lot, I think, of collaboration that is beginning to be made more easy to facilitate that. Sharing a screen is, I think, simple. You know, there are methods, Google Docs, where you can allow for simultaneous edits with multiple people. Well, that's the definition of simultaneous. But yeah, anyway, that allows for this as well. But when I think about the GameStorming application, for example, that exists right now in the iTunes Store, great way of, I think, helping teams kind of break through their thinking to say, well, what game might be appropriate to help me solve my problem right here. But there's a bit more. The next step from there, in my mind, would be how do we enable teams to come to that collaboration space and have the monopoly money, tools, houses, whatever, to affect the game and then continue to play its way forward.
Sure.
So that's kind of where I was heading with that.
Yeah, just to build on that, you guys are kind of making me think of something that's been on my mind lately, which is also, I think there's an opportunity, or at least it's an interesting question to ask, to make collaboration, to not think of collaboration as an event, but just something that's always ambiently happening. And building the conditions and the environment and the tools in some cases to make that happen. So when I think about things like that are coming out of the consumer space, like co-viewing experiences where we can like watch TV together remotely and have a chat window open all at the same time, or co-listening experiences like Last FM and things like that. Those start to set up some of the raw ingredients for doing this in a slightly different way, which is not like, okay, we're going to get together at 9 a.m. and collaborate, but we're just going to always be doing it. The door is always open, right? Something along those lines.
Exactly. And you know, James, just to share with you, I was just reading the back of the book where I tend to write things to remember for later. You know, one of the items that I jotted down here a while ago was, thinking about Wacom tablets, things like that for faster sketching, libraries of clip art for fast illustration of ideas. I found myself in a meeting. I was channeling you. I felt like I'm thinking about James, where I was putting together an architecture document as we were having our discussion around isolation layers and how they're going to work, and we want to make sure that things are on the both sides of the isolation layer. We're not doing something special off to the side that we have to cater for later. And that discussion was happening all verbally. And I right there in the event, I put together just a couple few quick boxes and illustrated it as like, yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So you know, we're focused a lot on the technology aspect of this, primarily because we are geeks, and secondarily because we're thinking about the distance element of this too. Yes. But having those libraries seem to me to be very important.
I'm just wondering, how much do you guys encounter resistance to the idea of, and I mean, this is something we've talked about on this show before, but encounter resistance to the idea of games at work or using gaming techniques to brainstorm or whatever, because there's that you know, idea that they, because you're playing a game, it's frivolous somehow. There's no serious outcome.
Right.
How do you overcome that kind of problem?
This is work. This is serious. What are games? Games are play. They go somewhere else. I actually encounter it less and less. But to go back to that culture comment, it really depends on what you're walking into and what the situation is. The way that I counter it is I try to meet people where they are and take them just a small step in one productive direction. So, for example, if it's a group that needs to come up with, say, a common vision for where they're headed or something, and they've got 5 hours to do it, and they're under strong pressure, and they're just honestly, you can assess pretty quickly like if they're in a place where they can even solve this problem or not. You just meet them where they are. So instead of asking them to stand up and hey, let's role play this new experience, or tell me about the new future from by acting it out. I might just say, hey, let's do something simpler. I want you to write out four words, and you're going to write out four words, and then we're going to post these up and start from there. The funny thing is, though, once you get people moving, once you give them permission to start playing, whether you call it a game or not, they appreciate it. So it's really just a matter of getting unstuck from that initial friction and then going from there.
I think the thing that strikes me is that I recently went to an event which was called a Makeathon in London, which was set up by a creative agency called IDEO. Mm-hmm. And a very interesting thing for that was, as I said to a few people, I commonly go to a tech event and I see the same tech folks, and we're all kind of, I guess, relatively, hip and freewheeling, but you see the same crowd. Whereas in this particular case, the tech people were in the minority almost. There was maybe 10 people there out of 60 who were, primarily software developers and people who do web design. The rest were very much kind of people that do product design, human factors research, and were much more on the kind of creative industry side, if you like. And they led us through a brainstorming technique there, which was very interesting, and some of the stuff that you talk about, particularly in the first half of the book, around getting ideas up on the wall and so on, was really the kind of things that I was seeing there. But it was actually it was fun, it was immersive. We were engaged as a group. We were challenged to put aside preconceptions and think about different ways of doing things. So,
yeah. Last quick comment on that is there's certainly different cultures across industries as well. So one of the times I was most anxious in my experience was actually going over to the UK to facilitate a meeting with a bunch of government bankers. And I thought, oh my God, this is, how am I going to do this? I don't even think I have the right shirt to wear to this meeting, for one thing. And so I was anticipating a lot of resistance, but then I was pleasantly surprised when I showed up to find that actually they were just people like everyone else. And you know, people, when you talk about sort of games and play, it's something we naturally do anyway. I mean, you know, even if you're not explicit about sort of games that are in your workplace, you know, there are lots of them. I mean, I throw out some skeptical ones, like, you know, the game "I agree with the boss more than you do," the game, what do you call it? You know, like Saboteur, which is where you basically wait till the end of the meeting and then throw out a reason why it was a total waste of time.
Or so, gotcha. Gotcha is always fun.
Gotcha. Yeah. So there are lots of, we do this naturally anyway. There's a great researcher, philosopher, cultural anthropologist. I'm going to say his name wrong, but Roger Calois, who wrote a book called Man Playing Games, which I would totally recommend if you want some really good, like, nighttime reading. And he talks about sort of the different types of play. I won't go into them now, but they're things that we all naturally exhibit, and in work contexts or not. Our bodies, or who we are as humans, we don't recognize the difference. And what he called out in particular was an interesting tension, I think, between wanting to just play like children without rules, mm-hmm. and wanting to build structure around our play. It's something that we naturally do. We want to build rules, but then once we have rules, we want to play with the rules themselves and pull ourselves back into childhood. So just to think about that from perspective of, like, the next meeting you're going to, you know, what are the rules that aren't written down that people are playing with, and why is that happening? And is there a way to kind of make that out, to take that and turn it into a positive energy, you know, to take that and make it explicit and, you know, try playing some new games.
I will take that into account, as my next meeting is going to be at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. So,
wow.
Yeah, that'll be fun. So as we're getting to wrap here, so here's one quick thought for you, James. Knowing what you know about us, are there any recommendations that you have for us as co-hosts and with our co-host Michael for games that we ought to play with our podcast or perhaps even with our listening audience?
Gosh, well, what are the problems? I always like a game that solves a problem or a challenge. There are lots that that could be played in terms of just getting to know each other better, you know, like on the games thing in particular. There's one game that I like to play, especially when we're developing something like a learning game, or it's about games in particular, which is you just draw an element from one of your favorite games. So, for instance, if it was Monopoly and you wanted to make it hard to get or easy to guess, you would draw, you know, the cannon piece or the what was it called? What's that thing you put on your thumb? The thimble.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that as a good opener with people for a way for people to get to know each other a little bit, because everybody has a good story to tell around a game that they've played, and basically what you do is everybody draws the picture of it and you try to guess what the game is, and then they tell the story. It's a pretty quick icebreaker too. I could see it being done via Instagram or something. I don't know how the technology works around this, but, you know, maybe we could figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Well, cool. Well, I know we're at time, so James, I'd like to say it's been such a pleasure talking and playing with you here with these ideas on the phone and or on the podcast. I think I've learned quite a bit, and I'm sure our audience has as well.
Yeah, it's been really good fun, James, and thank you for joining us, and also thank you for and your co-authors, of course, for a really interesting book. As I said at the top of the recording, I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I'm really looking forward to dipping into it and exploring it some more. Where can people find you online if they want to follow you or learn more about you or catch what you're up to?
Yep. Awesome. I am at MacGeo, MacGeo on Twitter.
Cool.
And I love to, I keep track of the GameStorming hashtag, #GameStorming. Mm-hmm. And I love to see questions and dialogue and things go back and forth. I'm usually pretty responsive on there. So I love to hear how the stuff gets used in the wild. I think it's cool. Happy to rant about it anytime. So thank you guys for having me.
Excellent.
And as my little witty close for us, I did remember what I was after. The God particle kind of reminded me of this. So if you want to check and to see whether or not the Large Hadron Collider has destroyed the world yet, there is a website you can go to. And we'll include that in the show notes, which we've included before, but it came up again yesterday in the context
worth checking,
of work.
I think, you know, because you never know.
I check.
Good drill. Thank you.
All right. Well, I think that's a wrap. And Andy, anything else?
No. Just looking forward to a weekend and relaxing. And I'll be heading over to the U.S. in about a week's time. So I'm looking forward to that as well.
Lovely. Not anywhere near North Carolina, are you?
I'm afraid not. No, it'll be down in Austin and then up to Virginia. So not too close, I'm afraid.
Well, Virginia's closer than you think.
Okay. Well, I'm British. All these distances look really ridiculously large.
All these states confuse me. They do. Too many of them. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back with you again for another episode in short order. Thanks.
Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and you can follow us at Twitter at GamesAtWork_BIZ. We'd like to thank the guys at Zebes Systems for their rocking version of the Moon Patrol game theme.